Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we begin the show by talking about life in the driftless area of Wisconsin. And Reggie McLeod back with us, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. So I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe you live in the driftless area. What's been happening around your area? Tell us, we're going to be talking about ferries. Maybe you've got an experience with the ferries on the Mississippi, or what do you want to know about their history on the Mississippi? Lots of things to talk about. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
You know, I was reading your January-February issue, and right off the bat in your letter from the editor, you call 2024 the year of the refuge, and it's the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge's 100th anniversary. And maybe talk about why I was amazed at I had forgotten how enormous this refuge is, but why is it so important for us to celebrate and protect it in the future?
Well, it's kind of interesting. We kind of forget about it because it's one of those things that's so large you don't see it.
Yeah, right.
It's 261 miles of the river, so it starts right at the bottom of Lake Pepin, where the Chippewa River flows into the Mississippi, and it goes almost down to the Quad Cities, where the Wapsipinicon River flows into the Mississippi. And, it's huge. It's 240,000 acres of land, and it's important because in much of the rest of the river, they've built dikes and then pumped the water out of the bottomland to grow crops. And so you don't have the islands and the backwater channels and backwater lakes that you have on this stretch of river. I mean, this is, I believe, the best stretch of river of the whole Mississippi because of those backwaters and the islands and such. And it was saved 100 years ago because businessman and sportsman from Chicago, Will Doak, liked to come out here and hunt and fish, and he saw that it was being threatened by development, and he formed the Isaac Walton League and lobbied Congress. I think it took him about a week to lobby Congress and get the law passed that preserved the refuge, and it's almost miraculous, and it's still there. And it's so many people that live on this stretch of the river in four states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. They enjoy it. You can go out there and camp for free. You don't need a pass or a sticker or, you know, pay a fee. It's just an amazing resource for the whole upper Midwest, and it's even more amazing for all the birds and the fish that use it. I mean, it's probably critical for, millions of animals that use it.
Absolutely. Can you imagine? No, I can't. You can't. I don't think you could imagine somebody going to Congress and in a week getting approval on 261 miles along a river.
Well, getting approval on anything, frankly. Those were different times.
Oh, man.
Say that, yeah.
And there are a lot of, you highlight, it's kind of nice, you highlight many events that are going to be happening in celebration of the refuge.
Yeah, it's the first big event is going to be on March 9th in Lansing, Iowa, which is right across from DeSoto, Wisconsin. And there's a gentleman there who grew up in the Onalaska, Wisconsin area, Steve Marking, who has a show where he kind of becomes Will Doak and talks about the refuge and how it was formed. It's kind of like a, you know, one of those Mark Twain shows that you put together. And he's been working on that and a movie that he's going to, I don't think he's going to show the movie on the 9th, but, you know, we're going to add events all year. There'll be things going on all year, and there's a good website where you can really kind of keep up with these events. And if you Google UpperMiss100.com is the address for it, but if you Google Upper Mississippi Refuge Anniversary or anything like that, you're probably going to be sent there too.
Yeah,
and that's changing constantly. We're going to be adding to it throughout the year.
It's a really, really cool event. Ross in Crawford County has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry and Reggie. Reggie, we got my friend and I, we have a subscription to the Cedar River Magazine. It's really cool. It's really great. You do an amazing work. You probably got to hire more people to do all the work that you do. I've got property over in Crawford County, more on the east end, but I'm, you know, sort of near Linksville when I get over to the big river. What it is, and if anybody's listening, it's never been to the Driftless, you have to come. It's just this amazing, beautiful area. And I think, in my mind, part of the reason that makes it so beautiful, it's unique, you know, geology and stuff. But, I think it's because agriculture wasn't able to completely sort of use everything, take everything. You know, so there's these hills, there's these valleys where, you know, modern agriculture just can't get to. The Amish can kind of work it, but in small farms. But so it sort of preserves this. It has this older feeling to it. That's kind of the main feeling that I have about this area. It really is. It's just a beautiful area.
Ross, thanks. Reggie, I imagine you're going to agree with that.
Well, I certainly do. there is agriculture in the area, of course, but there are smaller fields because we have these dramatic, you know, 400, some of the bluffs are more than 400 feet high, and steep land that really can't be farmed, so it's wooded and has a lot of wildlife. And a lot of the fields are really small, especially when you're close to the river. So that makes it pretty inefficient to use the huge machines that a lot of farmers use now. So it helps Amish people fit in nicely. They can work it very efficiently. And there's a lot of organic agriculture going on in the Driftless area because of that, too. You know, it's not the big production stuff. And it's a lot of nice trout streams because of the a lot of springs and
it's not only beautiful place.
But I used to live down in Brownsville Township in Minnesota, and I think that township was about 60% wooded at least, and that's cool. You don't find many places like that, especially in this area outside of the Driftless area.
Yeah. Ross, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have I always enjoy going through the recent news from your region, which you usually always highlight in the magazine. We have a lot of listeners in Minnesota, and there are some important environmental updates for well owners there. The EPA, sort of in no uncertain comments, had some words for the state of Minnesota and told them what they needed to do.
Yeah, it's environmental enforcement is a very complicated thing politically because a lot of times it adds expenses to developments that involve a lot of jobs and money. And so it's a little awkward sometimes for the state agencies to be aggressive as perhaps a lot of people would like them to be. And I think in this case, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was seen by a lot of rural people, actually, as kind of dragging their feet on protecting the groundwater. And so the Environmental Protection Agency came in and said, you know, they've got to figure it out and get to work on it. So I think a lot of people, in fairness, I'll bet a lot of people in the Pollution Control Agency like that, because that gives them a little more power to do what they'd like to do and may not be encouraged to do. I'm trying to be diplomatic about this. But, yeah, a lot of people have wells that they've been using for decades or longer, and they shouldn't be drinking the water now, often because of nitrates in the water, which really makes it basically poisonous to infants. But also, it's not good for anybody to drink water with high nitrates. It's associated with all kinds of health problems and cancer and so on. So, yeah.
They're going to have to step up. Eugene and Viola, let's go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
That area from Steuben down to Waseca, the river, Kickapoo River, swings a big horseshoe bend and comes back into Waseca. And that is just plain gorgeous during the summer. They built a railroad. They started the spring of 1892 out of Waseca, and they brought the first train into Lafarge in 1897. And they had 34 bridges, and they had to go through that swampland.
It was quite a comment on that. Yeah, that's a quite a story, Eugene. Comment, Reggie?
Well, I don't know much about that railroad, but you know, it wasn't that long ago that was a principal method of transportation, really, especially if you wanted to haul any crops or anything in bulk. I know that valley is another incredible resource, and it's interesting that there's so much protected land that's connected to the refuge. And so the Kickapoo is largely, you know, public land now, I think, pretty much almost all the way up to the state park, the Wildcat Mountain State Park. And so it's a huge area of public land now, and that's an interesting story in itself, why it's like that. And the backwaters around Waseca are just amazing. I've paddled around in those. But then the lower Wisconsin River is a basically a refuge that's protected too. So the refuge is a wonderful resource, but it's connected to so much protected and wild land on the Chippewa River, too, as well as the Wisconsin River and several other rivers.
Yeah.
And then you have the tertiary or secondary tributary then with the Kickapoo River, too, which is developed into quite an amazing place.
Absolutely. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Louise in Dodgeville, we'll go to you. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
We lost her. Her question was about, is there really a Driftless National Park?
No, there isn't. And that's another interesting story. There was an attempt last fall to establish one kind of in the Whitewater Valley in Minnesota, which is the area between, say, Winona and Rochester. There are thousands and thousands of acres of public land there, and the backwaters where it flows into the Mississippi has a large area of public lands and prairie and so on. And the weather man on a television station in Rochester was pushing the idea of turning it into a national park. And he got very quickly, a lot of people reacted negatively to that for a number of reasons. Principally, you know, they were worried about eminent domain being used to seize farmland and so on. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, sports people, and I've fished on the Whitewater quite a few times. We can do that now without having a pass or, again, paying a fee or, you know. So national parks tend to have more limited access than we have out there. And I think a lot of people were concerned about that, too. So that idea was dropped. There was an earlier idea about having a national park in Grant County in Wisconsin, too. And that didn't get much traction either. You know, and I can kind of understand that, because in a way it's a lot easier to use the public land around here and on the refuge than it is to visit a national park, I mean, frankly. And if you tried to fence and controlled access to some of these places, it would could be nightmarish, I suspect.
Reggie McLeod, our guest today, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, the January-February issue out now. Great to have him with us. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at life along the Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Dave in Toma. Dave, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm really happy with your guest this morning. I love him and the people you have from the DNR on there. He's got a great platform to promote saving these areas by promoting moratoriums on new roads and sanitary permits so that we don't lose these areas. And that would be a painless thing to do that I think a lot of generations would appreciate in the future.
Yeah. Dave, thanks for calling. Comment, Reggie.
Yeah. Well, I should emphasize that our purpose is to do good regional journalism. So we don't advocate any specific policy or solution, but we try to publish a lot of information about the problems and about the possible solutions and what other people are doing and are maybe not doing in regard to some of these problems. So we want this to be a healthy area both for the people and the land and the wildlife, and that's kind of our mission as doing good journalism, but we're not going to generally take sides. We really want to get all the information out there so people can make better decisions.
Freshwater, before we go back to the phones, I wanted to just mention the freshwater mussels. Many are in danger. Many species in North America are imperiled or even extinct. But a team in Dubuque, and you write about this, has a plan to help mussels. What are they doing?
Well, there's a couple places that are doing a lot of research and work on freshwater mussels. And one is the fish hatchery in Genoa, Wisconsin, and also at the National Mississippi River Aquarium and Museum in Dubuque. They've also been doing a lot of research, and that museum is right on a little natural inlet on the river called Ice Harbor, and they've been monitoring mussels in Ice Harbor for a number of years now, and in kind of building programs to extend their research. And a lot of people are working in kind of planting mussels in places where they have disappeared, but where they used to thrive. So they're doing that sort of work there too, the research and actually and restoration.
And they're doing it because mussels are a part of the river's ecosystem and kind of an important part.
Yeah, it all fits together. You know, we used to see a lot of species as being individual things, and you just restore one part of it. Well, okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. To restore any species, we've kind of learned that you have to restore the habitat first, because if you just throw the animal out in a place where it's not supported by the rest of the ecosystem, it won't thrive, it won't reproduce. So freshwater mussels are an important part of what sustains fish and plants. They filter things out of the water. A lot of them reproduce in cooperation with a specific species of fish. So you need a specific type of fish to be there for the mussels to be able to reproduce. So they're an important niche in the river ecology that's vanished because of water quality, but also people used to harvest mussels to make buttons. So if you look at, if you have a shirt of buttons with buttons on it, which is becoming less popular all the time, but if you do and you look at those buttons, chances are those plastic buttons are made to look like mother of pearl.
Yeah.
That's because, 100 years ago, most of the buttons people had were actually made out of freshwater mussels, and a disproportionate share of those mussels were harvested from the Mississippi River and turned into buttons in the river towns, Prairie du Chien and Lake City, Minnesota, and Muscatine, Iowa was the biggest button manufacturer in the world. I think they were really cranking them out there. The alleys were filled with mussel shells with holes in them where they had drilled out the buttons. So that's why we're trying to restore them now, is because that had an enormous impact on the populations.
Grayson in Ontario, Wisconsin, will give you a chance. Hi, Grayson.
Hi there, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm 77 years old, and I grew up in the Kickapoo Valley. I moved away at age 17 because there was no way to make a living here. And I didn't want to starve like my dad did on the farm. So I left, and I moved back, 20, 25 years ago. And, it's a wonderful place. I feel at home. It's a beautiful scenery out my door. I own a little land with the trout stream on it, some of the best deer hunting in the country. So the land has stayed the same except for the woodland. When I was a child, we had no wildlife, but when the farmers quit pasturing the woodland, everybody, all the wildlife came back, and now we have a lot more deer than what we really need. But the land has changed a little, but the social fabric has changed a lot. I have a few native neighbors, but most of my neighbors no longer live here. There are wealthy people from the city that have bought up all the land. And all the land, when I was a kid, you could walk for miles and miles and nobody cared.
Yeah. Grayson, thanks for calling. So the land hasn't changed much, but the social society climate has changed, Reggie.
Yeah. I agree. I've only lived here about 50 years, so I haven't noticed it that much. No, I actually have. And you do see a lot more no trespassing signs in this, but there's also a lot of public land. I think that's part of the balance. I when I first moved out here, I would just hike around and explore things, and I like creeks and so on. And, I could tell people didn't have their land posted, so I could walk on it, but people had it keeping an eye on me, and you could tell, you could kind of feel I was kind of a suspicious character. And so I hadn't fished much since I was in my early teens, but I started carrying around a fly rod when I go on hikes, and that made me invisible to people, and because they thought, oh yeah, it's another trout fisherman. And then I started trout fishing again, and so I do that a lot now. But I've noticed that, and what I would like to see personally is to have a healthier economy in some places around here. And when COVID hit, a lot of people were working from home, and I think generally, that a lot of people would move out of the big cities and work from their home in the country. They could sell a house in Madison and probably buy three houses in Crawford County or over here around Winona, and not that many people did that. And I thought the small towns would thrive because of that. And Some have had a little bump, but it hasn't had the effect that we expected. And they still can't build houses fast enough in the big cities. And you know, Larry, what home prices are like in the Madison area. And
yes.
For miles around Madison, actually. And you have places like Organic Valley that have created big international businesses in the Driftless area. I mean, that happens a bit. And in Minnesota, you have Mayo Clinic over there that employs a lot of people in the rural areas. But there are a lot of places where it's hard to get a job, and housing is cheap. Land isn't cheap anymore, though. It seems like land isn't cheap anywhere. I bought 40 acres with a house. It wasn't very good cropland. It was mostly hillside. I think we paid $20,000 for it. And this was in the late 70s, probably 76 or 70. Yeah, I think 76. And something like that now would cost 10 or 15 times as much.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to buy that now. So it's kind of, I don't know how you fix things like that, but I would like to see a change somehow.
Grayson, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Barb in Milwaukee has a different kind of question here, I think. Barb, hi.
Good morning. My question is, we have a camper, a really small one, like 10 by 6 or something, rustic teardrop camper. And my question is there any, where do you recommend going camping in that neck of the woods? We tend to go like along the Lake Michigan area, but we haven't gone out to the southwest side of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, there's a lot of wonderful places. You know, just in the Wisconsin state parks, Wild Lucene is a terrific state park. Down there by Prairie du Chien on the Wisconsin River, that's the first place I saw the Mississippi River from, was when I was camping down there many years ago. Perot State Park is great. What's the park in Cassville? I used to go.
It's not coming to me.
Yeah, I'll think of it when I stop trying.
And or somebody will call and tell us.
Yeah, Merrick State Park up river of Fountain City, Wisconsin, is a great park on the river. Some of these, like Trempealeau and Merrick, you can actually have a campsite that's right on the water, and you can bring your canoe and just leave it there and go out and paddle around and fish and explore.
Lots of good places. So, and you've just mentioned three really good ones. So,
Well, in the park in Cassville that we can't remember the name of, is you can get walk-in sites there that you're out right on the edge of the bluff. And I've been out there in the spring during the migration, and it's just I'm not a heavy birder, but my partner is, and she just would go crazy out there when the birds are migrating because they're stopping at our campsite, you know, all the time. It's just amazing.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just quickly, there are a lot of county parks, too, on the river that are very inexpensive to stay at on both sides, and state parks in all four of the states. But Wisconsin has some really, really great ones, yeah.
Barb, you could almost head straight west from Milwaukee, and you'd be right. You just keep going until you hit the river. You're going to find some places, but those are all good places that Reggie's mentioned, and you really ought to take a look. A listener called to recommend the Kickapoo Valley Resort as a place. So, just now. So they're there, and I hope you take a look at it. And if you go to travelwisconsin.com too, you're gonna type those things in, or just take a look at our state maps.
Yeah, and the Great River Road too.
Yeah, Great River Road is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I love that in the fall.
They have a lot of information too online.
Yeah, there is a lot of good information. So you got some things to work on here. Probably keep you busy for, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, and then there's Nelson Dewey State Park in Cassville.
There it is. No, we should remember that one, Nelson Dewey State Park. That's another great one, the one we couldn't remember the name of. Thanks, Barb. And you've probably given some other people some ideas about where to go.
Oh, well, I hope so. Yeah,
I hope so as well. Well, canoeing's come up a couple times. I wanted to go back to one piece. We have hardly talked about many of the stories. There's so many great stories in this issue of Big River. One I liked was quite a long story about some guys who canoed in a race on the Mississippi, and they four guys in one canoe, and they broke a record.
Yeah, they did the entire length of the Mississippi River from up in Lake Itasca, almost up to Canada, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico in less than 17 days, and they were paddling, you know, that's almost 2,400 miles, and they were paddling around the clock. They averaged 138 miles a day. They were paddling in shifts. And just to put that 138 miles a day in perspective, when I paddle 20 miles in a day, I'm done.
Yeah.
it's hard to even imagine it. It's pretty impressive.
They had, it was very well organized, because along the way they'd have people catch up with them or whatever, and they had food set up so that people would supply them with food as they kept going, and they'd maybe all four be paddling, but then sometimes one or two would just fall asleep in the canoe, and it's quite an amazing story.
Yeah, they were in that canoe that whole time, that whole almost 17 days. And they were delivering their food and sleeping and going to the bathroom and the canoe, and they had a team kind of following them along the river in boats and with I think a van, and it was one of the most impressive things besides the physical feat of doing that is the logistics. You know, to support it and keep them moving constantly. You know?
And I think they did a video, which will probably wind up as a little short special or something, I would imagine.
Yeah, I haven't heard a follow-up about that. Generally, when people do something like that, they write a book and or make a video. And I would be surprised if there isn't one coming out, but I haven't heard anything about that yet. But it'll be in Big River when it does. So
yeah, you wrote another piece about the ferries on the Mississippi. Man, there's quite a history of the ferries on the Mississippi River.
Yeah, I had never thought about it much, and I was asked to give a talk on ferries on a ferry down in the Quad Cities this spring. And so I thought, I don't know anything about ferries. And so I had to become a quick study, and really I learned a lot. And it was fascinating, and I'm still learning about these. I had taken the Cassville Ferry, which you can take to the Nelson Dewey State Park. No, there's the only ferry on our stretch of the river that's still operating is at Cassville, and they would really like to have a bridge across the river there, because it's about 60 miles from Prairie du Chien to Dubuque, and they're right in the middle. So when the ferry can't run in the winter and when the water's high and that, it's really kind of a burden for them. But, yeah, they have a lovely ferry that stays busy. It's a lot of people just probably take the ferry and turn around and come back on the ferry, because it's a nice little boat ride, but it only takes about 15 minutes or so to get across. But there were ferries that were powered by horses walking on treadmills and all kinds of crazy things that I found out about. The most amazing ones were powered by the current, actually. They would just turn the ferry boat a little bit on an angle, and the current would push it to one side, and then they'd turn to the other angle, and the current would push it to the other side. So, I mean, that's so brilliant.
Oh, man.
Yeah, talk about green energy.
There it was. Well, it's a fascinating story. Tom in Cross Plains has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Great that I was able to call in. The Driftless is such a beautiful transition environmentally from the North Woods and the Great Lakes to the prairies and the Mississippi River. And that edge area promotes a very interesting biotic community. It also promoted a lot of interesting conservation writers. And the Driftless brought us Aldo Leopold, John Muir, Augie Derleth, Hamlin Garland, Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's been a great area to promote people's understanding of the environment.
Tom, right. And Reggie McLeod. You didn't mention Reggie, but Reggie McLeod's another one of those writers. Comment, Reggie?
Someday. You know, that's so true. It's amazing. And we've been doing this for 31 years now. And sometimes people ask me where we get our ideas. And, you know, the ideas come in faster than we can do the stories. We have no lack of ideas for new stories that we haven't done before. I mean, this is such an amazing place culturally as well as geologically and the natural systems and so on. I can understand why writers were inspired by this. I know I certainly am, and a lot of the people that write for Big River Magazine feel that way too. So, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is important. And there are a few names that we left off here, but people are still writing about it, even beyond Big River Magazine. It's still a good subject.
How do people get Big River Magazine?
Well, they can go to our website, which is called BigRiverMagazine.com. So that should be easy to remember. Or they can call us at on the phone at 1-800-303-8201. Or they can go to Wisconsin Public Radio online, and you guys might have a link to our site there.
Yeah, we do. I'm pretty sure we have a link on today's date, ideas at wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date. But otherwise, if you just type in Big River Magazine, you're going to learn about it, or, again, that 1-800-303-8201. Reggie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Oh, always appreciate it.
Thanks. I enjoy it so much. I like talking about this.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And we didn't touch on even a tenth of the stories that are in the magazine this time around. Well, weather is always on our minds. It's always on my mind the last Monday of the month, because that's when our weather guys come along to talk weather and climate. Today we got weather guy, Steve Ackerman, up next to talk weather and climate. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Well, time to talk weather. It plays such a role in our day-to-day life. You know, if you think about your memories of the seasons, maybe you remember a big snow from your childhood. 10 years from now, people will be recalling, at least in southern Wisconsin, the big snow that hit just a couple of weeks ago. A lot of good memory, or maybe the cold snaps that we've had. Steve Ackerman back with us, one of our two weather guys. I don't know where John Martin is. He's somewhere.
Yeah, John's at the American Meteorological Society's annual meeting. I usually go to, but it just didn't work out for me this year. And I fell on a Monday, last Monday of the month. I'm not going to go give up this.
Steve Ackerman, that voice you heard, of course, if you've been listening for the last 25 years or so, you would know that voice. He's former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grant Education at UW-Madison, and of course an emeritus professor now in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. We'll talk about maybe partly cloudy and partly sunny versus partly sunny, and explain why the wind maybe is calmer at night, and certainly take your questions as well. Which weather events, maybe on the memory side, which ones stood out, stand out to you? Give us a call with your questions. Winds, clouds, snow. Join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Steve, in the middle of the month, I think we experienced the cold, one of the coldest days of winter. How does this winter compare to others historically?
So historically, it's again, when I think about comparing winters, I think of December 2023, this January and this February. That's the classic meteorological wintertime. And as you probably remember, December was really warm. And then we had that really cold outbreak. Those cold outbreaks aren't unusual, but coming after a warm December, it certainly seemed very, very cold. And I think many of us wanted it to end, including myself. And now we're at a period where, again, our highs this week are going to be in the upper 30s, low 40s, which is a few degrees above the normal high, you know, over the last 20, 25 years. So
we average it out.
I think we're going to average it out. We're going to end up with a warmer winter. Now, we also have a lot of snowfall because of that snowstorm you referred to a couple of weeks ago. And that really helped in terms of bringing us up in terms of the amount of precipitation because December was pretty dry.
Just thinking, you know, here we are. We're still in the first month of the year. Think back to 2023. Highlights or lowlights that that come to your mind over the past year?
You know, one of the things that comes to my mind with regard to 2023 was February 2023 also had a record snowfall, rain event, which was pretty obviously unusual since it was a record event. That and, you know, the really dry late fall, November, December that we had is also something that really sticks in my mind, dry and warm.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were way low on water, you know, our moisture levels.
And then we had January precipitation, and now
and now we're
about average, I think, maybe a little above.
In reasonable shape anyway.
Yeah.
And that drought and that when did that end?
That, oh boy.
I don't remember now.
I don't remember.
Emily in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but she says, talking about fog, we've had a lot of fog lately in southern Wisconsin. Her husband says it's when the snow melts and evaporates. Is that actually true?
Yes, except I might not use the word evaporate. I might use the word sublimate, which is, you know, basically evaporation for frozen water is sublimation. And yeah, we've been seeing a lot of that. You know, we live on the north end of Lake Mendota and, you know, wake up in the morning and it's completely foggy because it, you know, the sun isn't out, things cool down. The snow is sublimating, adding water vapor to the atmosphere. It saturates, and boom, you get a fog form. And it stays around until the sun really gets up and begins to heat things.
I'm going to ask you something that you may or may not know, but...
I'll have an answer.
Well, it doesn't really... Well, let me just say it. The start of the Wisconsin UW men's basketball games, every time there's something come out that looks like they shoot up a cloud of... It's not smoke...
Oh, outside or...
Inside. In the building, and it shoots up, and that, maybe when we take a break, I can. I took a picture of it the other night. I can show you a photo of it, but it's certainly not smoke because you'd smell it.
Yeah, I would guess it would be water vapor, condensed water in some form. Because if it is smoke, it's also going to set up fire alarms and things, sensors. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's. Right. I know it's not smoke, and I wondered. As I think it's got to be almost like fog in a way.
I'll have to take a look. I'll bet it is because I'm thinking in the wintertime, the other thing that we often do in our homes in Wisconsin is put in humidifiers. And that's one of the things. If you look at it, there's fog that kind of comes out.
Yeah.
And then it evaporates and helps humidify the home.
Well, maybe somebody.
Maybe something similar to similar process.
Maybe somebody from athletics, UW Athletics, is listening. Right. You can fill us in, but I'll show you a picture at our news break. But Carl in Verona has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I have a question about climate change and net zero. Does net zero take into account the feedbacks that are now occurring and starting to kick in that are adding additional warming? Or does it just consider the amount of carbon we add from burning fossil fuels versus the amount that's taken out by photosynthesis and whatever carbon capture we might have? Or does it also include the feedbacks that add to the global warming?
So when you say net zero, you're referring to the amount of carbon being emitted into the atmosphere being as a, versus that being taken up by the plants? Is that what?
Right.
I'm not familiar with the term net zero. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's how I understand. I've heard that. I've heard that as a goal. But I'm just wondering if that's all they're considering, then we're, you know, the feedbacks are adding additional warming to that, because they're also emitting CO2 from the thawing tundra and methane, and also from the thawing marine sediments in the Arctic, and then there's the darkening of the Arctic Ocean as the ice melts, and all those feedbacks are adding also, and I'm just wondering if the warming from them is factored in to this idea of removing carbon.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. I think it refers primarily or solely to the carbon sequestration, reduction in use, because you're right. I mean, the other component, the other greenhouse gas, which is a pretty strong greenhouse gas, is methane. And so as things begin to melt and defrost, more methane is going into the atmosphere. And I don't think that is included in things like net zero.
All right. There you go, Carl. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I saw your piece in the newspaper, your weather guy's piece about drones.
Yeah.
Whether or not somebody asked, are drones used in meteorology? And the answer is yes.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I think they've been used. So if you think of drones as unmanned aircraft, aviations. Yeah. NASA and NOAA have been using them to monitor aircraft. Used large aircraft to monitor hurricanes and look at the development of hurricanes. There's more and more use of the smaller drones that the public uses a lot, equipping them with observations to see what's going on in the lower atmosphere, because that's important for weather, and we don't have a lot of observations there. And so in answering that question, I kind of searched around and found out that the World Meteorological Organization is going to run a big global meeting where they're having 40 different groups from across the globe starting to use drones to make observations, and then are going to use that and put it into weather forecast models across the globe to see what happens in terms of how are those observations helping forecasts.
Yeah, in my mind, I thought, you know, it might have some sort of local or at least, at the very least, regional, but I mean local.
Local, really local impact for sure, because we don't have those observations. And if you have a special region where you have a lot of water or it's not similar to the standard National Weather Service observation site, you could have very different weather conditions, particularly in the lower boundary layer. Where fog forms, as we talked about earlier, right? We can see that from satellites, but if it's occurring in a valley and you don't have your observer there, it's not going to get recorded.
Jill, by the way, sent me a note. There are a number of ways to create fog inside, and she's a theater person, and she says, we do it all the time.
Right. Of course.
Steve Ackerman, our guest, one of our weather guys, he'll be with us right up until 12:30, and then we'll take Joe and Green Bay's question, and we'll take your question as well. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Steve Ackerman, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison and an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And of course, talking climate and weather, callers online, I've got questions, you've got questions. Let's go to the phones. Joe in Green Bay, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey, hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Ackerman. Thank you for the show and for taking my call. So I have a question on the upcoming solar eclipse on April 8th that's coming up.
Yep.
And my question really is, I want to try to plan for the weather. So I'm planning to go to Southern Illinois in the path of totality. And, you know, I already took a look at some information or what I can. And it's like, you know, I want to try to position myself where I think the weather's going to be historically pretty good sun-wise, and then try to have a plan if it isn't that day. So, I mean, what would you do, I guess, to try to predict what the weather would be on that day, position yourself, and then plan for any changes in that day? And then the second question is, I'm going to buy some solar eclipse binoculars. Do you have any experience or any suggestions on what the best equipment to view the solar eclipse would be?
Well, these are really good questions. I can tell you what I did just this weekend is, and my wife and I made reservations. So we're going to stay with a friend who's also a weather forecaster. The problem with regard to cloud cover and storm system is that it's just too early at this time. So it's best, I think, and what we did was look at where is the totality, where are there places to stay and make those reservations now. I've seen two total eclipses. So I ran that risk for Montana, one in Montana and then one in Wyoming. And it is totally worth taking that risk. I think as you get closer, there'll be better weather forecasts. You know, like a week out, those forecasts are going to be pretty good. And you can see if there's going to be weather storms or partly cloudy or partly sunny or whatever, and then decide whether or not to go down and hope that you luck out to do that. With regard to things to look at, what I remember bringing to the Wyoming one, which was the most recent one, I think it was just a few years ago, was welding glasses. So somebody had welding glasses, and then you could look at it more sustainedly than just glancing up. In the one in that I saw in Montana, which was back in 79, 78, I think it was, we didn't have any of that. But what we did have was somebody looking at the satellite imagery. And then early in the morning, we called them up and asked, where's a good place to go based on the satellite imagery? And then we drove there. And we did something similar to that in Wyoming. So that might be something to do, get set up on where you're gonna be in April, and then look at local weather forecasts and see where is a good place where there is going to be enough open sky that you'll be able to see something.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully within an hour's drive or so, you'd be able to move.
You'll be able to move, right. Yeah, the swath is pretty, I don't remember now how thick it is geometrically, but it, you know, you could see a good area, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck with that, Joe.
Yeah, good luck.
Report back to us after that event.
it is an amazing phenomenon to see. I know, again, where we ended up saying it, we're in these open areas where there were no trees. And so as the Terminator came towards you, you could see the Terminator racing at you. And it was just, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. Or inspiring.
Good luck, Joe. Thank you. Yeah. Dean, who is west of Denver, Colorado. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good. Well, I guess good afternoon out that way. Thanks for a great show. I appreciate you guys being here every month. I have a quick, I don't know if it's a quick question, but, you know, models have evolved, weather models, over the years. And I was wondering how fast they are now responding to changes in surface, like going from a dark surface to all of a sudden snow cover, and that being a feedback to go into the model update last forecast.
So interesting.
That's a really interesting question because it goes back to our drone question as well. So they're quickly responding to big changes. You know, so like we have a snowstorm here, or if you have one in Denver or in the Front Range, that'll get into the forecast relatively quickly. Where you end up having some problems with regard to getting the observations in quickly is things like fog, regional fog, things that may be going on in the Rockies in Colorado or in the Front Range by where you live. Some of that may not get into the forecast as quickly as we would want. Part of that is associated, again, with not having the observations, where, again, low-altitude drones might be able to provide that kind of information.
So what would be quick?
The next weather forecast cycle. So they're not doing a forecast every hour. I think they're doing it now every 6 hours. So if there was a change right after that 6 hour forecast, then that's not going to get in until the next forecast. Yeah.
All right.
Good clarification there.
Dean, thank you for calling. Robert in Stevens Point, we'll give you a shot now. Hi, Robert.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Say, Larry, I'd like to ask your guests, where in the world are the effects of global warming not taking place? And if so, why?
No.
Boy, that's a good question. In my mind, I cannot think of anything offhand, particularly regionally. There may be local things that are happening, you know, in valleys or small geographic regions, but I cannot think of anything off the top of my head.
In other words, it's pretty much
it's global. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Nowhere to escape it.
Nowhere to escape it. Yeah. What I'm now thinking in my mind, and again, I can't come to anything quickly, is in some changes with global changes, you may have more precipitation, and that might be beneficial to a particular region. But again, off the top of my head, I can't think of any places where we're seeing that benefit.
Robert, thank you. Matthew in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Matthew.
Thank you very much. Hey, a while back, I listened to a talk by a Dr. Radley Horton from the Columbia University Climate School. Mm-hmm. And he said causes of last year's warmest temperature was, of course, El Nino climate change and a massive volcano eruption in the Pacific Ocean, which I never heard of. But now I'm wondering if there isn't another connection, and that being since we are at the closest point in the Earth's orbit about the sun, that we are receiving a greater amount of solar radiation, which then heats up the Earth's mass and the Earth's atmosphere, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Two things. One is the orbit around the sun, as you're saying, we change our distances, and that's usually accounted for in these analyses of global warming or global impact. The record warming that we saw was a combination of the trend that we've been on due to CO2 emissions, but also El Nino. The volcanic, I hadn't heard that. Usually volcanic eruptions like Mount St. Mount St. Helens would put aerosols into the stratosphere, and that leads to a cooling. Pinatubo was a big effect on that, on the global temperatures. But since it's an ocean volcano, then I'm wondering, did the volcano and the lava lead to a warming of the ocean temperatures in that area, which again would then lead to a positive feedback on the global warming, or at least the large scale warming in the Pacific or Atlantic where that occurred.
Interesting. Matthew, thank you. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Chris in Milwaukee County. Hi, Chris.
In 1999, I attended a lecture by a UW-Madison physics professor, and I learned two things. And I'll explain those two things, and my question will be, has anything changed since 1999? The first thing I learned is that, just to simplify things, there's a grid across the United States of temperature sensors. And the professor said if the number of sensors is doubled, if the grid becomes finer, that's worth doing. But if that is expanded, there's a falling off in ability to predict the weather. And the second thing he said was that in principle, because of chaos theory, there is a two-week limit as far as weather prediction and probability, that even if we add to the number of sensors, humidity, temperature, whatever, nature has imposed a two-week limit. Is that still true? And I'm not talking about long-term change like the Anthropocene. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you clarified that. Yes, I think there's still that two-week limit in terms of weather forecasting in a particular region. Things would just get out of hand. Now, John may disagree with me since that's his area of research, but we'll have to get back to him and ask him about that. With regard to the temperature sensors, I think it has changed from the following way, and that is we have significantly improved the computational capabilities. So the physics has stayed the same. We know what those equations are. But as computers get better and better and bigger and can do more processing of data, instead of making approximations about some physical energy exchange, we can actually do those calculations. So I think, you know, the general feeling that I have, my general attitude is the more observations we have, the better our forecast can be, provided we can get it into the model in an accurate way.
That's interesting. Interesting questions, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. Mike in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. My question is a follow-up for some of the questions about the global warming and the El Nino. Since our El Nino stuff is about, 15, 20 years old now, I'm wondering what the effects of all these wildfires we've had across Canada and across the United States that we've basically done nothing about for the past decade, and how that has affected our current climate and weather patterns, as along with the global warming thing, if there's any data currently being developed based on all these massive amounts of wildfires that can melt an entire city in a matter of minutes.
That's a good question that I don't have an answer to. I'm sure that somebody's been looking at what happens when you have these big fires. And I don't think the smoke aspect of that or the heat aspect of it, I mean, that's a really big impact regionally. I think the global impact will come when the fire is done. Now you've changed the land surface. You've changed the energy exchanges over a large region between the ground and the atmosphere. And that tends to have a bigger impact on weather forecasting than the short term with the fires and the smokes that are occurring.
Yeah. That makes good sense. Well, that's another one. John may have a comment on that next time he's around. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the call. Joel emailed to say he lives in Hurley and wondering why there's been so little lake effect snow this year in the Lake Superior snow belt.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we felt a little bit of some lake effect from Lake Michigan the other day. We had some very light snow, and I was surprised. So I looked at where the winds are coming from. And I think that's the answer, is that we really haven't had the winds coming from the right direction over Lake Superior, because clearly the lake's been cold enough. And the atmosphere is in the circulations. We've seen precipitation in the southern hemisphere, I mean the southern Wisconsin, but we haven't seen it really around Lake Superior. And I'll bet it's related to the wind flow.
And the wind is not as windy?
Well, it's not flowing from north to south in that area.
Or it's
not very strong to one, get the moisture off the lake, and then two, to get the little upslope that's occurring on the southern part of Lake Superior.
Phil in Marshfield emailed, he's heard that there are two aspects to the polar vortex, a stable and an unstable aspect. He's wondering what causes the unstable aspect and how does the unstable aspect affect our regional weather?
So the unstable one, and John's talked about this a little bit over the different times, because this is an area that his research is about and he loves it.
Yeah.
The unstable aspect is generally gets associated with as I understand, when we look at the temperature gradient between the North Pole, I'm going to refer to the North Pole because this is where we live, and the mid-latitudes tropics begins to weaken. And when that weakens, the jet stream meanders. And when the jet stream meanders, it can plunge southward and bring all that polar air into our region. And that's what we felt back in mid-January. We had that cold air outbreak come down. And that's one of the things I think John is studying, is looking at, as we see some global warming, what's happening to the temperature gradient, and will that mean a more stable or a more unstable jet stream? Because if it's more stable, then we're not going to see as many cold air outbreaks as we have in the past.
Well, that last one was
a doozy, right? And he was very excited about it. Me, not so much. Right? I'm a radiation guy. I like to see the sun. Right?
Me too. Oh, boy. You know, I've got a friend who occasionally will say, somebody will ask about what's the weather going to be, and he'll say, well, it's going to be partly cloudy and partly sunny, and then he feels like an idiot. And you do hear partly cloudy, and then you'll hear instead partly sunny. What's the difference?
Yeah. So the National Weather Service trains observers to make sky observations of the cloud cover in eighths or in octaves. Mm-hmm. So if there's no clouds, I'm going to go back, obscured clouds. So if it's a very thin cirrus, that's not considered in the observation. So you could have 100% very thin covered, and it'll get reported as zero cloud. If it's, I think, 1/8 to 3/8, it's partly cloudy, or it can be mostly sunny as well. So you could report it as both, unless it's nighttime. If it's nighttime, you can't report mostly sunny. So mostly sunny, partly cloudy are the same. And then I think mostly cloudy would be, I think it's 4/8 to 5/8 or 4/8 to 6/8 cloud coverage.
So you got, if you're measuring it, you
yeah, I think it depends on how optimistic you feel, right? So, right, if it's partly cloudy, you can report it a partly cloudy. If you feel gloomy, well, you can say it's mostly sunny. Yeah.
And we've had some questions. This has come up relating, and you mentioned wind earlier. Why does wind move slower when it's closer to the Earth's surface?
So it generally happens at nighttime. And so, the wind increases with altitude. And during the daytime, the sun heats the surface up, again, if you're not over water necessarily. And that couples the higher winds up above to the surface winds. And that's why it's really often windy during the daytime as opposed to the nighttime. During the nighttime, we don't have that solar heating. The ground cools off and the ground air becomes stable, and so we get decoupled from the upper atmosphere. And so at nighttime or early morning is often when we find our less windy conditions.
I saw in the Washington Post, I think it was, there were a story about some jets passenger jets that were going like 800 miles an hour because they were they caught the jet stream.
Yeah,
the jet stream that was really faster than normal or something, and they were landing, you know, on these long trips an hour and a half early.
Really? Yeah, yeah. and that's part of what happens when you fly planes, and if the weather doesn't get in the way to cause a delay, you know, sometimes you land early, sometimes you land late. If you're going from, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere and you're going from west to east, you're more likely to end early than east to west, because you're likely to be flying in the jet stream when you're going from east to west.
I remember on going on the Grab Our Bike run, which was essentially going from east to west. And I realized why a lot of people, when they're going to go across the whole United States on bikes, they always go from the west side to the east side. Because it's a whole lot simpler.
And I know I did a bike trek about when I was in high school out at Montauk Point in Long Island. And way back, the wind was in our face the whole time. And I just hated it.
Well, how do they measure wind speed, by the way?
So they have anemometers primarily, you know, so the wind cups, you generally see them. Yeah, that's the standard way. There are more sophisticated ways now with lasers where you can do better estimates of the turbulence within the wind. Those anemometers with the wind cups, they're going to be averaged over a few minutes. But these new ways with lasers or sound can get you
really accurate.
Get really accurate and get some of the variability that you miss with the cups.
Well, Steve, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And next month, well, there'll be a whole new set of things to talk about.
There will. We'll still be ending winter, but it'll be something to talk about.
And John will probably be back from his meeting.
He better be. He has to teach.
Steve Ackerman, our guest today, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We were talking about this before the show. I think we've been doing this 25 or 26 years thereabouts, so it's always been a lot of fun. And he'll be back. And the last Monday of next month. And coming up tomorrow, though, sooner, we'll take a look at the women brewers who helped make this beer beverage part of our state's history. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.